GMGM, everybody, welcome back. Hello, welcome back to another episode of If You Know, You Know, the show for Web3 creators and enthusiasts. I am your host, Belle, and each week I'm joined by Web3 experts to bring you the latest trends, opportunities, and perspectives from the creators who are shaping the future of technology and art. Nothing we ever say is financial advice, and it's always important to do your own research. If this is your first time joining us, thank you so much. Love to see new faces in here. We do this show every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Eastern, at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time from all you people in the East Side, in New York especially. And you can also find us in any of your favorite streaming platforms. I want to take this moment to quickly encourage everyone to share the room and get some more people in here. I feel like this is an amazing conversation that we're about to have. But that, and while we get some more people in here, I want to remind everybody that today's show is powered by Tao. And in case you missed it, last week, I announced my partnership with them, and we kicked off the partnership by launching Space Caps Poops, where each week you can collect a new Space Caps commemorating that week's special guest. Last week, you were able to collect for Rokes, and this week we have Snowfro himself. So our partnership with Tao is a really special one to me because our values of trust, access, opportunities, and attention are perfectly aligned. So if you haven't already, make sure that you take a look at the pinned post that I put up there that explains everything that you have to do to be able to claim today's POAP. And let me know what you think. I would love to hear your thoughts and what you're thinking about the program already. I think the art up there looks beautiful. So I'm hoping that everybody else does that too. You have to like, retweet, and comment on that one. Take a look at that pinned post, and I think that I'll remind everybody at a later point also. But let's kick off today's show. I'm super excited. This is a long time in the works of me manifesting it. Snowfro doesn't even know this, but it's been a long time for me personally manifesting it and throwing it out into the world. Eventually we would get here. And so I am so proud and so honored to have you on here. Rick, welcome to the show. I am so excited to have you on. How are you today?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited to be here too. And thanks for manifesting it.
Always. I think that that's how you bring things to the world, right? You manifest it. And eventually I'm a strong believer that, that it happens, like that's just the way that things happen. So super excited to have you on here. I want to take it, like, I want to have the conversation with you for a lot of our listeners, I'm proud to say, are not very familiar with Web3. We always have a fantastic mix of people who are here for like the very first time, just, you know, popping in, learning more about NFT technology, about digital art, etc., all the way to people. I see some like amazing faces right now. Shout out Jimena, shout out to so many friends that I see that are ingrained already in the NFT space. But Eric, I want to kick it off with who you are. To me, you're like the grandfather, you know, of generative art and NFT, and anybody in this space absolutely should know who you are. But I want to take it back because sometimes we get into these really nuanced conversations that are hard for other people that are not here every day to pick up on. So founder and CEO of ArtBlocks, grandfather, I'm coining that, of generative art in this space. Eric, tell us a little bit about who you were. Let's start from like day one, who you were before you got into digital art scene, and, you know, and let's start there.
Wow. Okay. Well, going way back, yeah, I think just have been an entrepreneur by nature as a, like, starting since I was a little kid, and, you know, kind of realizing that entrepreneurship is an art form in and of itself, getting to sift through millions of ideas over the course of a lifetime and deciding which one you're going to throw your time and your energy and your resources and failures and be willing to fail with, and, like, then, you know, kind of sifting those up to the the three or four that have kind of like made it to the top, the things that I've dedicated my time to. And I've been a hobby coder since I was really little, copying snake game scripts into a graphing calculator and all the other things that we could do back in the day before the internet taught us how to really code. Right before starting Arblox, actually, I started a company. Well, actually, in 2004, I started a company in the world of ceramic tile, working with kind of high-end tile factories and high-end architecture firms, and working with architects and designers to put tile into really cool projects. I still have that company, actually, and still spend an hour a week working with them and just kind of helping guide that. In that time frame, I kind of I met my wife, who I credit for unlocking like a whole creative side of me that I didn't know that I had, and started making artwork. A lot of that artwork was being made using code, and you know, one of the impetuses for starting Artblox and most of the things that I believe in are that there's things in this world that I wanted to exist that didn't exist. And after looking around and saying, okay, well, I want this to exist, like the only way to make it happen is to do it yourself. So this is where I spent, you know, a significant amount of time working through the idea that code can create visual and audio outputs, and did that for several years before I discovered Ethereum, fell deep into the rabbit hole of Ethereum, got really excited about the technology, and then started realizing that there is a part of this technology that facilitates the concept of generative art or algorithmic art in a way that did not exist in the same way without it. And so that's not to say, you know, you call me the grandfather of generative art in this space, and very grateful for that. Although the history, the predecessors that come before me are way more instrumental in the fact that we're even able to have this conversation today. So, you know, people like Casey Reese and Lauren Lee McCarthy, and then even before then, just the people that were creating generative art with raw code before creative coding was facilitated through libraries like P5JS and processing. But, you know, being able to like just take a step back and realize that when I entered the space, I made a commitment to myself. A, I wanted to do something in this space. I love Ethereum. I love smart contracts. I was just completely blown away by all of these things, but also made a commitment to myself that said that anything that I did in this space would not be a square peg round hole use case. Like, we all love blockchain and we all wanted to find ways to use it. And a lot of the use cases for blockchain technology felt like they were just like blockchain, 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 but they weren't actually solving a problem in the real world. And there's been very few that I think really have solved problems in the real world. I think digital art is a really good example of a use case of blockchain technology that really elevates the medium of digital art, and obviously subsequently generative art. DeFi is a really great example of just something that, you know, facilitated transactions in a way that we couldn't really do before without having to trust a bunch of parties. And I made that commitment to myself that I really wanted to build something that could not really functionally exist in the same way without the technology. That slowly led into what Artblox is today and what we're thinking about for the future.
Tell us a little bit about Artblox Engine. One of the things, Eric, that I've always been so impressed with you and your demeanor in the space is you are very quick to talk about the people that surround you and very quick to talk about the people that, you know, that you work with. You show a lot of grace and a lot of decency and are always happy to shine a light on the people that are, that you work with and that you surround yourself with. You're very active in the giving away a lot of your NFTs, philanthropic and et cetera. So I want to talk a little bit about that. But one of the things that that I love about Artblox is Artblox Engine, and I'm not quite sure that it gets a lot of attention. Talk to us a little bit about that.
Well, I mean, first of all, regarding the people that you refer to, like, I wouldn't be here today. We wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for these people. And these people compose of artists. These people are composed of our collectors and our community members. And these people are composed of my team and then my family. And like, I think there's a lot of grounding that's necessary in Web3. I think we live in this crazy world where like everything is just so easily taken for granted, especially during bull markets, and everything is just kind of like nuts. And the reality is that we are all humans and we're individuals, and there's only so much that we can do alone by ourselves. The idea of coming up with stuff, the innovation, the vision of the future using this technology, that's something I'm very proud of. I think that is like my highest leverage contribution to the space, to art blocks, et cetera. But executing on that vision is something that requires teams. And whether it's, you know, everything from my wife putting up with my excessive travel and kind of like nightmarish schedules to, you know, a team of 40 people at ArtBlocks that, you know, kind of has to deal with a lot of the crazy thoughts of, you know, what the future looks like, and every now and then kind of like having to pivot and make some changes. But then also helping artists and collectors understand the true value of what that technology is. And, you know, in terms of ArtBlocks Engine, you know, where if you really kind of scale back, and this actually came up on a call today, the original version of ArtBlocks, the very first incarnation of ArtBlocks, was essentially ArtBlocks Engine. Because I went even as far as making sure that the headline of the website said generative content on the Ethereum blockchain, not necessarily generative art on the Ethereum blockchain. Of course, I come from a generative art background. That's my passion, is art and code and all these things. And so there was a very clear use case for this technology within art. And that was the easiest use case. Pixels on a screen was the easiest way to kind of demonstrate the power of this technology. But, you know, we often think that, like, you know, ArtBlocks Engine existed first and ArtBlocks Flagship come behind there and had been the first customer of ArtBlocks Engine. Like, being able to have that conversation sometimes is a little bit hard, because we started with ArtBlocks Flagship, or at least so it seems. What happened with ArtBlocks Flagship is that we started getting such high caliber art that it felt like a disservice to the caliber and value of those artists and those collectors to allow content, generic content, and when I say generic, I mean non-art content, to exist on the platform. And so it carved its own path. It carved its own way. And it is personally one of my greatest, like, proudest achievements in my life is what has happened through ArtBlocks, what we call Flagship, or, like, you know, the ArtBlocks.io platform that is focused on art. But the original idea behind this was to let people use this technology to facilitate distribution and dialogue for generative content. And ArtBlocks Engine, over time, you know, we have this, like, moment where, you know, I was talking to Jeff, this is very early on, and a couple other people on my team, and there was this discussion of, like, what happens if Pizza Hut wants to release a project on ArtBlocks? And, you know, at this point, we already had 8 months of, like, some of the iconic generative art, and I say iconic pre-blockchain, like, these are artists and projects that I had been watching form on Instagram and Twitter and Reddit for years before they were released on ArtBlocks. And at this point, we have this, like, beautiful art there. We say, okay, how would it look to have archetypes next to a Pizza Hut NFT? You know, and we've never spoken to Pizza Hut, to be clear. I'm just using them as an example, or a guinea pig. And, you know, Jeff, who is very much art focused and art minded and comes purely from an artist background and entrepreneurial background as well. He ran a print shop as well, and a print studio. But, you know, it's like he made a very good case, and I think it was a very fair case, that, like, it would be a disservice to have something like the Archetypes project next to a Pizza Hut NFT. And this is where there was this need for me to make sure that I did not contradict my original intent of, like, letting people release stuff in the generative medium. And so that's where the concept of ArtBlocks Engine was born. It was originally called Powered by ArtBlocks. And it was this idea that, like, we build infrastructure technology to let people mint in this way, using this medium. And I think what's happened is that now the concept of, like, a purchase flow or a mint flow has been commoditized so dramatically. In other words, anybody now can spin up something that allows you to mint a generative NFT, render a generative NFT. And because there's at this point dozens of platforms that do the same thing. And so thinking about, like, what ArtBlocks Engine is, ArtBlocks Engine is not just like, oh, here's a mint button, here's a smart contract. Our smart contracts are open source. Like, it's beyond that. It's thinking about what the opportunity and the potential is of the technology beyond just, like, that base infrastructure. So ArtBlocks Engine is here to facilitate, to help people that have ideas, they're curious about the distribution mechanisms. There's artists that are curious about how they kind of create their own path. A really great example, one of my favorite engine examples, is Raphael Rosenthal. He's an artist that's released on ArtBlocks, an early net artist that has gone off and created his own ArtBlocks Engine infrastructure website, and does his own releases at his own cadence. No one's talking about that diluting the ArtBlocks Flagship experience. This is just him releasing his own art using this technology. And we want to facilitate that to happen to any organization or individual that feels an opportunity to distribute work with this framework, with this concept of generative. And so, yeah, our Plex flagship has become this home for not just generative art, although that's a significant amount of the use case for it, but generative fashion, generative goods, like design goods, and maybe even generative toys one day, and generative like fun stuff. And we want to position ourselves to be like the best place to come and do that. Like, if you have an idea of something generative, why are you building something from scratch that's already been built 50 other times? Like, there's this infrastructure that's in place that supports it, both in a slow economy like this. But if you guys remember that Artblox actually started developing infrastructure during the 2021-2022 bull market, and our focus was being able to handle a project that had 1,000 mints that would mint out in 30 seconds. And while that technology and that like hardening of the technology may not be felt today so much just because the market is a little bit slower, that infrastructure is in place and it's ready to be able to handle a massive amount of generative content being minted. So Artblox flagship is essentially the provider, a service provider that can power things like Bright Moments. It can power things like Artblox flagship. Engine can power Bright Moments and flagship and Prohibition on L2 that allows like low cost minting, and then just, you know, generative goods like Trem that's done the tapestry with Alexi Andre. Plottables for people that like really like plotters and the ability to mint something that specifically not just creates a plotter type drawing, but gives you the functionality and the tools to be able to plot the drawing. And these little tributaries, I believe, are the future of generative individual expression, and giving the most surface area with the lower barriers of entry for people to be able to produce this kind of content right now feels paramount as what we can offer the entrepreneurs, whether they're entrepreneurs from a business perspective or from an artistic perspective, a place to release their work.
Every artist that, you know, it has a drop on Artblox speaks about the experience and speaks about the desire to be a part of Artblox with such a pride of doing so. And one can understand, you know, as an outsider looking in, one can understand where that comes from. But I've also heard you talk a little bit about how when you first had the idea and you were sending, you know, DMs to different artists and having the idea of Artblox, nobody really cared. How was that? I mean, it you know, there has to be, first of all, there has been such a change, such a tremendous change in the mentality. But talk to us a little bit about that. You know, it put us in the world of when you were launching Artblox and seeing how people thought about it versus today. And what do you think the difference is?
Well, I mean, I think the main difference happened between launching Artblox with a backend only. Essentially, it was just a smart contract and some very minimal infrastructure, versus launching Artblox with a front-facing marketplace or aggregation for people to be able to see all the work that had happened up until that time. Essentially, the original version of Artblox was Engine, and even more original than what you saw in 2020, in that it was like, okay, here's a smart contract, here's what it does, you know, and here's a way that you can demonstrate the variety of an algorithm without having to manually produce each one. At the time, people didn't care, partly because they didn't even understand what an NFT was. And back then, to explain an NFT, you had to explain what Bitcoin was and what Ethereum was and what mining was and then what a smart contract was and why a decentralized ledger is so important. And I think what shifted so dramatically between the 2018 when I started pitching these things to 2020 when I finally launched it was that there was baseline understanding of the technology that didn't exist at the time. And we had heard about NFTs at this point. CryptoPunks had started getting quite a bit of attention. CryptoKitties and plenty of other kind of projects that launched in that time frame. And CryptoPunks had kind of started going up in value. And TopShot generated, I think, what, like 500,000 wallets in 6 months. And people that, even though they didn't have to interact with the blockchain directly, they were exposed to the concepts of blockchain and to digital ownership. So I think it was just like the technology, the sentiment and the understanding of the technology caught up to what the technology could offer people. And I think that was the single greatest difference in the adoption, I guess, in 2020 versus the adoption in 2018. I mean, you know, even going back to 2018, like the moment that I thought of Artblox, I came up with it in 2017 while minting CryptoPunks. I later pitched Larva Labs, like the idea of like this minting process where like, you know, you don't know what you're going to get and the smart contract gives you the thing, and use the CryptoPunks example. I said, if you ever do a CryptoPunks version 2, I should not be able to pick all the rare CryptoPunks. I should be able to say I want one and be able to be, you know, granted the one that I want. Like those things were so just like antithetical to the way that we kind of saw what blockchain could do. And we were so focused on just like the purely digital ownership perspective and not the distribution mechanisms and the mechanics, that I feel like it just wasn't time for those things yet. And I'd go as far as saying that because I do believe that generative art is such a killer use case for blockchain technology, for digital art, then also being able to understand the technology after seeing just one or two or three projects launched on ArtBlocks made a huge difference. I mean, I had people running ArtBlocks testnet in early 2020 and mid 2020, and those people were kind of starting to understand it. But there was like 100 people max that were like tinkering with testnet, you know, coming to CryptoVoxels and letting me talk about it. And I'll never forget, you know, getting to speak on a couple of the shows, you know, about what I was doing with the technology. But then what changed is that I think, because generative art is such a strong use case, such a clear-cut use case for blockchain technology, the product itself became the chassis for other people being able to understand why generative art and why digital art and NFT technology makes so much sense. So I think it kind of snowballed into like an easier understanding of the technology once we understood like why this even works in the first place.
Blockchain technology, cryptocurrency, all of it, Web3, if you will, gets such a bad rap, right? With everything that happens in mainstream. You now have found yourself in a position that you're going out and publicly speaking in a lot of different places. You were invited to be at TED Talks. Super looking forward to that. You also went to Harvard Business School. They wrote a case about ArtBlocks. Does it get easier? Are you finding yourself being more accepted, or not yourself as a person, but, you know, the technology that you are discussing, is it being understood more and appreciated?
Sure. I mean, well, and also I'm disappointed, but also kind of relieved that the TED Talk has been postponed. So I will be announcing that here in a little bit. But yeah, so between that and then like the Harvard Business School thing, I think what the biggest thing, for example, with the TED Talk, like I think I was going to use the word NFT one time in the entire TED Talk. And I think in the similar kind of like jump from 2018, when you still had to explain mining, to 2020, where you could say the word NFT and people could go kind of figure out what that means or not. You shouldn't have to understand how the technology works in order for it to give you value. I think we've also just come a long way since 2020 to today in that we have to explain less, and people can just kind of understand less and participate more. And I think a lot of these public speaking opportunities have been an opportunity to really not have to focus on the technology. You know, I was giving lectures at like, you know, high education, like, you know, like very, very high art schools and universities in 2021. And, you know, those are hour and a half lectures, of which like the first 45 minutes still had to explain what's generative art, what is generative content, what's algorithmic art. And while we still have to explain that to people here and there, it's become such a predominant part of our conversation. Like when you can explain to someone that CryptoPunks is generative art, Bored Apes is generative art. Like these are things where an algorithm, like each one of these outputs was not handmade. Each one of these outputs was based on a algorithm combining features. And it starts to just kind of become more natural. And we can start talking about the value of the technology, not necessarily from like the digital ownership perspective, because that is now just kind of like clear, I think, to a lot of people, but in terms of the distribution mechanism and when the creativity is applied, not just to the ownership value proposition, but when the creativity is applied to the distribution mechanism, and when the creativity is applied to the dialogue that happens after the mint, that's where we're seeing like this new opportunity to disarm the audience and have them understand, hey, like maybe you don't like NFTs, fine, but let me explain this to you. And you tell me how this could happen if NFTs did not exist. And if you think that this is interesting and you don't like NFTs, then like you've got to kind of make a decision here. Like if you think that some of these things, for example, artist Def Beef, one of my favorite artists in this space, and someone that's really just kind of like been very innovative and kind of like the very front of a lot of these things, it's like, do we love what Deaf Beef does? Because even to the person that's not within the ecosystem, they can see the value, the pure kind of raw nature of his work and like how he kind of like presents himself through this technology. Like, do we like that? Because if so, then like we have to embrace this technology. And if the problem is you just don't want to hear the word NFT again, which I totally understand. I mean, I multiple times I'm going into an interview and I just like, I tell the interviewer, please don't use the word NFT or like, let's not refer to these things. Like, we're not talking about the technology anymore. We're talking about the content, the distribution mechanisms, and like the opportunity that arises because the technology exists. I think that's really changed the dialogue. I think that enables me to have a more disarming conversation with the general public. I think it's an opportunity for everybody on this spaces and everybody in this ecosystem to really think about how they communicate the value proposition of this technology beyond just like the word NFT and really focus on the content and like what happens when creativity can really just flourish outside of having to understand how MetaMask works.
I love that. There is that I want to give you that I found really interesting. I'd love for you to talk a little bit about that. The first part is something that I touch on, but the second part is something that I want to touch on right now. And here's a quote that you said earlier this year. As much as I appreciate secondary market royalties, I even more appreciate decentralization. So you touched on the way that this goes out, right? And the opportunities, et cetera. Why do you appreciate decentralization as much as you do?
I mean, without the decentralization component, CryptoPunks wouldn't be what they are today. ArtBlocks wouldn't be what it is today. And I didn't create ArtBlocks because of secondary market royalties. ArtBlocks was able to, generate revenue because of secondary market royalties. Artists are able to generate revenue, but like, putting the cart before the horse there, like that is such an important component of our ecosystem. It's something that is so powerful and it's drawn so much talent and so many artists into this ecosystem. But the reality is that like secondary market royalties could have existed in the real world prior to NFTs and they didn't. And NFTs give us an opportunity, like digital objects give us an opportunity to really kind of perpetuate that again, to restart that conversation and to get the dialogue flowing again. And another opportunity to not miss the opportunity, as so many opportunities that we have today in Web3, whether it becomes a diversity conversation or the royalty conversation or gatekeeping or whatever it might be. These are opportunities that we have at the forefront of a new technology that has found product market fit to make changes in the way that society operates. But one of the things that's so important is that while secondary market royalties were never baked in, and I think that was a misperception that a lot of people had within this ecosystem, they became part of our culture. And the culture is very, very powerful, but you can't force culture down someone's throat. I can't think of a quicker way to ruin culture than to force someone to operate within a certain culture. On the other hand, the decentralization black and white interpretation of a smart contract in the code, that is something that is not necessarily forced down someone's throat. That is just inherent in the way that we operate. And so giving up the sovereign nature bearer of the asset, giving up the ability for an artist to modify metadata or to modify and just like, create something that the user that now holds it knows with absolute certainty that they are the owner and no human can intervene in their ownership. And on-chain generative art specifically is an elevated version of that, in that all or the vast majority of the information required to reproduce that NFT lives on the same protocol that allows them to trade it and transfer it to each other. And so, by forcing culture, I think we end up kind of like hurting ourselves in the long run by embracing the culture and identifying the people that are participatory of the culture, the patrons of the arts, the collectors that are actually following the careers of the artists. I think that there's like a bigger opportunity to have that culture thrive and persist. Like a lot of people blame Blur for what's happened in the ecosystem. They were the first, they were the catalyst. They were the catalyst for the reduction of royalties. Obviously, like, would love to have had OpenSea continue its dialogue about creators, because that was a lot of their like, selling point of their platform initially. But if it wasn't them, it would have been somebody else. And so if we keep fighting, it's, it goes back to like early ArtBlocks and one time when we saw that people were minting too many, we like put a smart contract restriction where you could only mint one per wallet. And so then people would just spin up 100 wallets and mint one to each wallet. It's like it's a cat and mouse, like chasing your tail thing, where like there are some things that you inherently cannot solve for. You cannot fix without giving up some of the things that make you proud to be part of this ecosystem. And trying to fix them feels like a waste of energy, whereas instead trying to celebrate the culture of the people that are operating within the way that we want to operate, feels like a much better way to channel very limited bandwidth that we all have in this ecosystem. And I think what that means ultimately is that it's up to the platform and it's up to the artist to champion the concept of royalties and have people understand why royalties exist. You don't have to have anybody understand why the smart contract gives you an immutable asset at this point anymore, at least not within this ecosystem. That is table stakes. That is guaranteed. That is an assurance that gives value, technical value, to the content that we're putting out there. And so now we have to focus. It's like, okay, well, you know, why are there people on Patreon that make $60,000 a month with hundreds of people paying $5 to $20 a month supporting them? Because those people like to have early access to information, want to have dialogue with the artists, want to be involved in like the creation process. Maybe they get to submit something like that. Nobody questions the Patreon model as a way for an artist to have sustainable income without forcing them to release more work. The royalty model in Web3, in the way that we interact with each other, is a model that encourages the artist to stick around and to participate. And one of the things, I think that there's a very, very clear connection between the artist's participation and the value of their work on the secondary market. I think maybe there's some outliers in there, but for the most part, the artists who have been able to sustain both their primaries and their secondaries are the ones that are out there interacting, thought leadership pieces, defending the reasons that we're here, defending the culture, coming out to events. These things have costs to them, whether they're like mental costs, like mental health costs, or like financial costs. And that cost needs to be subsidized somewhere. And so like, I think that there's a very strong reason for why royalties are a powerful thing in this ecosystem. But from a black and white perspective of why we're here because if Larva Labs have released the CryptoPunks on a server and we all logged in with a username or password and claimed our punks and then started using PayPal and credit card transactions to rewrite the database on the server as to who owned that CryptoPunk, a CryptoPunk would not be worth what it is worth today. I say that fairly confidently and objectively. Maybe I'm wrong. Like, that is what brought us here today. Those value propositions are what brought us here today. And we can't even have a royalty discussion if we don't have that value proposition in place. So that's a very long-winded answer. It's like why I said decentralization is more important than royalties. Like, royalties are like moot if we don't have decentralization in place to facilitate these conversations.
Absolutely. That was a really answer, but perfectly answered in really important concepts in the space that that I think need to be a lot more. When royalties started to go away, a lot of artists also started to go away and say, all right, look, if there's nothing here that, you know, supports me as an artist, what should I be doing here? And why is it even attractive for people, for new people to come see what I am producing, make it sustainable? And how do I get seen when, you know, I'm competing, so to say, with so many other amazing creators who are also, you know, wanting to have the light on them? How do I get to break apart? And when I do break apart, then how do I get to reap the same benefits that predecessors were able to reap the same benefit? That's a hard discussion for a lot of us. What would you encourage people to think about?
Well, I think the first thing we need to do is give grace to the artist that, just like the collector that is figuring this out as we're going, we are writing this playbook. We are figuring this out as we go, as collectors, as founders, as artists. And so just how collectors can be confused sometimes and confused why there's no utility or confused about whatever it is that like might have brought them here in the first place, I think we have to also understand that artists do not have all the answers and will not have all the answers for a really long time until everything is settled in terms of like what the playbook is in participating in the space. And I think one thing that's really important that we can't really like, you know, dog on artists for, but like have to be aware of, is like, we are asking people, if the artist is like discouraged by the royalty conversation, we are asking collectors to sign a social contract to support royalties. releasing in the NFT ecosystem, as an artist, as a creator, you are signing a social contract to participate in the NFT ecosystem, whether you get royalties or not. Like, if your thought is, I'm going to sell this thing and not want to have anything to do with it, like, the part of the beauty, what makes this so powerful is the dialogue and the ongoing conversation that happens after you create something. And so unless you're going to mint an NFT but not sell it to the Web3 Twitter space, but instead sell it through a traditional gallery or an art fair or whatever, and only utilize it purely for the technical value of the technology, if you are going to come into the space and advertise your art and your process and your craft to the Web3 audience with the intention and hope that the Web3 audience will follow you and buy your art and collect your art and participate in your journey, in the similar way that we are asking collectors to sign a social contract to support us in secondaries, especially when something is bought for $20 and sold for $40,000 later. It's like, does it really hurt that much to like share some of that success with the artist? I think similarly, the artist is signing a social contract and saying, hey, I'm going to be around. I'm going to stick around and be here. And just like collectors were angry and discouraged with the royalty conversation, and artists were angry and discouraged with the royalty conversation, there's people that stuck around on both sides. And I think ultimately, if you're not willing to sign that social contract of engagement, and that doesn't mean you have to tweet every day and like be there every single day, I just mean like not give up is really the answer, then like maybe you shouldn't be trying to sell to this audience. Like, this is on both sides, like on the collector side and on the artist side, there's this like nascent desire to have your cake and eat it too. Like, we need to understand, and this is where I go back to like the artist is figuring this stuff out as they go. And so that's why we give them grace, because they might not have realized that they were signing that social contract. And so maybe this just isn't for them. And same for the collector. They didn't realize they were signing a social contract on royalties. And so maybe that conversation is not for them. We have to be open-minded to every single person in this ecosystem, having come from a different place with a different set of rules and a different set of perceptions, and create the desire to participate in a culture of what makes this ecosystem so powerful and so beautiful and so like massive. And one of those things is, in this case, like participation. We as collectors in this ecosystem, I'm a collector as well, right? Like, I enjoy the participation of the artist. I enjoy seeing what they're working on, their process on Twitter, their contributions in the Discord, etc. Like, I enjoy that. I'm not saying it's a requirement, but damn, like, I value that enough. And I think that secondary market prices often reflect that. And so then you have a chicken and the egg thing where it's like, well, I'm doing all these things, but I'm not getting secondary market royalties. Well, but you are finding some collectors that are supporting you with the royalties. And those are the collectors that you might actually want to listen to what they have to say in terms of like helping you with your career and helping you on how you message your work. There's just so much here. There's so much going on. There's so much opportunity. There's so much to learn. We can't guilt people for operating in a certain way. We can't guilt artists for leaving. We can't guilt collectors for not paying royalties. But we can surely celebrate the ones that are realizing at all the boxes that this technology and this type of ecosystem checks off in terms of like leading to a beautiful art-filled world. And the more you participate, the more you lean into that, I think long-term, the more everybody will benefit. The more you support the artist, the more the artist will support you, and vice versa. And it's hard to quantify that. It's hard to tell a collector, hey, if you pay royalties today, in a year, you're going to get some really badass like experience, whether you get to have dinner with the artist or whether you get like some free mint on some project. I don't know. There's no way to promise that. But over time, I feel like those things will kind of come together, and there will be a status quo. And that status quo will essentially create the next generation of the most prolific collectors and the most well-known and established artists within the digital art movement. And I do think it's naive to think that digital art is not going to continue to grow as a medium of expression within a more digitally native world that we're living.
Recently, there was a lot of discussion, to exactly your point, without having what I was going to prompt this and ask you about it. But I want to know if there's anything else that you add on that. There was a lot of discussion going on Twitter, and, or I should call it X. There was a lot of discussion on X and in spaces about what the role is between the collector and the artist And it's exactly what you said, the chicken or the egg. What comes first? Is it the responsibility of the artist to educate the collector on what makes that piece so special? Or is it the collector's responsibility to research enough of the artist to already know what makes it so special?
Yeah, that's a hard one. I think it's both. I think an artist coming into this space and hating the prototypical kind of like NFT collector probably should then also try to capitalize from that prototypical NFT collector. That includes some things that are touchy subjects like financialization of art, which is something that I try to stay as far away from as possible, but also acknowledge that it's perfectly not just possible, but that like NFT technology is a brilliant way to financialize art, not just in like this buying and selling and flipping, but in like the loan process and the collateralization. There's some crazy stuff that can happen here that's really exciting from like a nerd point of view. But like, if you're going into this and you're like, oh man, these NFT people are crazy and I don't want to put up with them, but here, buy my art anyways, I think that's problematic. I think it's more problematic today than it was 2 years ago when people didn't realize the social contract that they were signing. I sure as hell didn't realize the social contract that I was signing when I started getting into this space. I mean, I saw it happen with Larva Labs, but I was like, man, you know, A, I never thought my project would ever even be in dialogue with something at the scale of Larva Labs. So I was like, oh, that can't happen to me. And I think that's got to be fair. I think you've got to understand that a lot of artists that have found success in this space probably entered the space thinking, okay, well, yeah, that's those people, but like, I'm never going to get to that point. Like, I'm just going to do these things and maybe I'll get to have a little bit of dialogue. Ultimately, I think same for the collector. Some collectors have turned into massive collectors and thought leaders in the space. I don't know that they entered the space thinking that they were going to be thought leaders in the world of art. I think they entered the space thinking that there was like an opportunity, an economic opportunity, or like an opportunity to like experiment with a new innovative technology, whatever it is. And they've settled into this like patron role. I sure as hell didn't think that I would ever be considered a patron of the arts. 5 years ago, even as an artist creating these things. And so again, it's like that unknown, like let this thing work its way out. Let's find out who are the people that are supporting each other, the artists that are supporting the collectors that are supporting the artists. That doesn't mean that people that are not, you know, bilaterally supporting each other don't have a place here. But when the people that are bilaterally supporting each other are celebrated and elevated and find a quicker path to visibility and adoption and success, that starts writing the playbook of, hey, if you want to be successful in this space, this is a certain amount of table stakes things that must be checked off first. You must agree that you're going to have dialogue. You're not going to attack people for the way that they sell your art or buy your art or trade your art. You're not going to attack other artists for the way that they make art. Like everybody, and same with collectors, you're not going to shame people for selling. You're not going to shame artists for not doing one thing or another. We're just going to all live here in harmony. And the people that are able to understand what the limitations of the smart contract technology are when it comes to intersecting with culture, I think are going to be the ones that thrive. And whether they thrive financially or whether they thrive emotionally, gosh, that's up to them to decide what path they want. But like the opportunity is there for fulfillment. And this ecosystem is just like prime ground for fulfillment. If you're interested in kind of trying to feel things out empathetically and understand why people act the way they act, put yourself in other people's shoes. It's just like green pastures of what can happen. And I think a lot of people are learning that quality, that kind of like human quality in this ecosystem, because there's a lot of people in the space that are passionate about trying to express empathy and open-mindedness and et cetera. So I think there's an opportunity to grow as a human in this ecosystem. There's an opportunity to grow as an art collector, whether you're an enthusiast, a critic, a speculator, whatever. There's an opportunity for you to grow as an artist in understanding what people want, what people's desires are. Like there's so much opportunity. And we're
Oh man, I think we lost him. We completely lost him. It looks like he got rugged. All right, guys, give me a couple of seconds. Hopefully we can get him up here as soon as possible. I am going to open up the floor for any questions. If anybody wants to come up here, let's get you lined up. I want to say we probably have maybe time for about two different questions. And or if you're in a position that you can't come up to the stage, feel free to write them on the bottom right hand corner is a little chat. I just started it saying, I hope you're enjoying the show. Drop your questions on there. And then there he is. Let's get him in here again. Hey, Eric, looked like you got rugged.
Yeah, I have no idea where I was, and I feel like that's fine. Let's move on, because I was just rambling as usual, so thank you.
Oh, man, those are the troubles of trying to do this live. I actually just opened up the floor, if that's okay with you, to have a couple of questions. I hope you're okay with that.
Yes,
we have time?
Yes,
okay,
yes,
cool,
let's
cool,
do
cool,
it.
Cool, cool. Let's do that. Give me just a couple of minutes. Also, want to remind everybody, you can also write down the questions if you want to do that. Let's see here. Getting up here. One of my favorite human beings. Jimena, how are you? Welcome to the stage.
I'm so nervous. I feel like talking to a celebrity.
tell me about it. Welcome to my world.
And that's you, though. No, I'm just kidding. I know Eric. I don't care about him. Just kidding. So honored. You always have like the absolute best energy and so empowering, and you're such a good speaker. I am a little bit nervous, but actually the question is about L2, and I'd love for you to kind of share your thoughts on the new platform, Prohibition, and this goes for, you know, any creator in this space that's thinking about you know, exploring with generative art at low cost and just kind of doing things that are more explorational and maybe feeling, you know, less pressure, you know, to play with the medium. So, yeah, your thoughts on L2 and kind of a little, maybe an educational pitch for anyone interested. That's all. Thank you so much, Bill. This has been awesome.
Oh, man. Well, first of all, I just want to say Jimena is someone that I've been off and on communicating with since, like, gosh, maybe the very beginning of our blogs. I remember when you first came into the server and you started asking questions about generative art and P5 and coding. And I know that it was tough and it was complicated, especially at the beginning. And I'm now a very proud owner of a generative art piece that you released. And I could not be more excited that I have watched this journey from the very beginning, and because of Prohibition, I was able to secure one of your pieces, and I'm just so proud. Like, this is an example of like what this ecosystem can do, and the opportunity that this ecosystem can give. So thank you for sticking around. I feel like there was many opportunities for you to be like, yeah, I'm done with this shit. So thank you. I think in terms of L2 and Prohibition, and you know, I just actually had the honor of spending, and I see Jordan's on this call, but like spending the last 2 days with Jordan. He flew out to Houston and we were, you know, jamming on some stuff and really like getting to talk about what this all means, what L2 means. And I think one of the most powerful things I can think of just from a starting point is that while aesthetically this cannot be said, technically an on-chain generative art piece is a technically high quality digital object, in that a on-chain generative asset is programmed often in a way, not always, but you have to do your own research there, programmed in a way where as the resolution of the screen grows, the art will grow with it and grow at the same rate in everything from line weight to composition, etc. And what that means is that in 20, 30 years, when you're looking at Jimena's piece and other people's pieces in this ecosystem that are releasing on-chain generative art, you'll see it on a 24K screen in the exact same way that you would see it today on an HD screen, without it having to be upsampled, without it having to be, and of course, by then AI will be so good at upsampling that it won't even matter, maybe, I don't know. And that is a very expensive process on L1. I mean, especially for an up and coming artist, the idea of putting just the pure minting of an NFT where all you're recording is some entropy data, a hash string, can cost from $5 to $15 just to mint the NFT. To upload the algorithm to the blockchain on L1 can cost hundreds of dollars, if not thousands of dollars. And while that's fine for established artists and people that like have conviction in their art or have been working on a script for forever, or you know, just are excited about, you know, L1 because a lot of people started on L1. I mean, my first L2 transaction was when Prohibition launched. It was the Emily Edelman piece. That's not for everybody. And this art form is not just about the visual outputs, although they can be very great, but it's about the distribution mechanism. And if we can facilitate that distribution mechanism to a broader group of people, we are increasing the surface area for creativity and for creative use of this technology to people that may not have been willing to risk uploading a $20,000 algorithm to maybe only sell a few mints of it and not even recoup the value of that algorithm. L2 enables us to really push forward the value proposition of art being on-chain, being able to reproduce the art at different scales in a deterministic way, which I think to me feels like the most digitally native form of blockchain art. It is the most native way to produce art on a blockchain because the information is produced all from the blockchain. And so L2 provides that as an opportunity. L2 also provides that as an opportunity for an up-and-coming artist, similar because you have to pay to upload the algorithm. If it costs $5,000 to upload the algorithm and you have an addition of 100, you have to charge $50 a piece just to make your money back. Well, but if you're an up-and-coming artist and you're just kind of like figuring out code and learning how to code or thinking through what a distribution mechanism is, you may not want to charge $50. You may not have the audience yet. You may not have the expertise yet, the technical expertise, whatever it is. And so you may want to charge $1 for a mint. And so buying something on L2, you can pay 17 cents. I've seen it be less to like actually mint the artwork on L2. And therefore you can actually sell something to somebody for $1 where they're getting quote unquote taxed 17 cents in transaction fees and start building an audience. One of the things that's so critical to me is that this distribution mechanism is so powerful that what's most important to me right now in general is that the artwork is distributed and saying, well, my artwork is worth $50. And if someone doesn't want to pay $50, like I don't want to sell it. That's fine. You should, as an artist, like be strong-willed and determine what the value of your art is, et cetera. But in terms of like speaking to a noisier and noisier and noisier ecosystem where there's more and more generative art, there's a homogenization of generative art that's happened over the last year and a half. Being able to just capture an audience by selling something for $1 so that you now have 500 people or 100 people that have your work that are talking about it on Twitter, that are touched by your message, whatever it might be, is what actually is catalyzed by this technology, is what this technology enables us to do. And so you can't do that on L1. You can't charge $1 for an NFT that costs $15 in gas to mint. You just can't. And so L2 is also a really wonderful opportunity for new artists to come in and just put themselves out there, see how people react to it, especially early on in a platform like Prohibition, where you can still scroll through all the projects and not get burnt out. Eventually, there'll be 1,000 projects on there. And just like, you know, I'm sure they're going to add really wonderful discovery mechanisms. But like, no one's going to just sit there and scroll through 1,000 projects. Right now, it's early. Right now, I'm on Prohibition almost every day looking at what the newest thing that was put up there is. And like, it's an opportunity to get your name out there with low risk, financial risk to yourself. And then for established artists, the artists that are willing to spend the thousands of dollars on their long form piece, let's say on Ethereum L1, just having a place to experiment with techniques and price points and maybe something that doesn't have like the level of intense scrutiny as what gets released on L1 or goes through like the highly curated processes like ArtBlocks, et cetera, just having a playground to put stuff and it just be low intensity is just really powerful and special. And, you know, I'm working on something really fun for Prohibition, something I cannot do on L1, and infinitely grateful for Jordan, for his team, for like just the initial artists that started putting stuff on Prohibition, for the initial collectors on Prohibition, to start kind of snowballing into some activity where there will actually be a home for this project and like a place to have dialogue over this kind of work. So L2 is so powerful. It's so exciting. It's finally mature enough to explore it. I don't think it was even mature enough last year to really, really dig into it. Indexing it, rendering, et cetera, is now like more streamlined. And just really, really grateful that it exists. Grateful for people like Jordan, Jason. There's a few other people that are kind of tinkering with L2 technology using ArtBlocks Engine. And then, you know, very grateful for the ArtBlocks Engine team and the design team and the product team for being willing to prioritize the efforts, the resources that were necessary for RBlocks to be able to start indexing and rendering on L2.
Awesome. Thank you, Jimena, for that question. And Eric, for that answer. Really, really good education. We got Seven. Seven, welcome to the show. What question do you have?
Hello, guys. Hello, Eric. I cannot believe I'm on the same stage as Eric and I had the chance to speak to him. Thank you, Bill, for hosting this space. Eric, you have no idea of the amount of ripples you have made in the culture of Web3. I'm a car designer from Saudi Arabia, and I worked in the UK a little bit for car companies. In December, I completely quit my job to focus on Web3, building as an artist, etc. Hopefully soon with generative art. Why I say that, I just want to say, like, thank you for doing this, because the crypto culture here is just about flipping and just saying, oh, what is the NFT to flip, etc. And now, since the market is down, everybody asks, okay, why Fidenza is so up? Like, what is this? What is Chromie Squiggles? And they say, what is this flow? I can draw this in my sleep. I'm like, whoa, hold your horses. And I've hosted spaces where I spoke, oh, look, these visual outputs actually have never been touched by a human being. The code is the where the curation happens. It's the code is the art itself. And these outputs come out of a code. And it just changed the whole narrative. And they say, okay, so how can we flip it? So when they say this, and we have all the necessary conversation to understand how this art comes about, they just end up loving it. And they end up really just admiring the entire process of it, completely generated on chain, et cetera, et cetera. So thank you so much for this. Okay, so I have two questions. Do you believe the generation process for the art, meaning during the mint, would change in the future at all? So meaning right now, if I'm sitting and I hooked up my MetaMask for a collection of art blocks and I want to mint it, but I don't know what's the output. Probably the best thing to do is to go and pick one up from the secondary market. But people sometimes like to mint. So would this be a process in the future where everything is generated and you just pick up an output? And the second technical question perhaps is, I'm not really sure technically how the entire thing, like when you click the live view on art blocks, is this being generated from a server or is it actually run from the smart contract on the blockchain? And thank you.
Yeah, no, thank you. One of my first things I wanted to do when I was a kid was be a car designer. So it's really nice to talk to car designers. And one day, in a very, very far distance future, we might be, you know, minting our cars, which I know sounds totally, absolutely delusional, but that is just one of those long-term dreams, that along with like minting homes and buildings, and et cetera. So for the technical question is pretty straightforward. So right now, and you know, there are initiatives that we have in place to kind of start making this even more durable. Although you have to consider what the time frame is between how important it is for this to be more durable versus other things that are more important to be building right now. But right now, it's all being rendered in your browser. So your browser is being fed the algorithm that is stored on the Ethereum blockchain. It is being fed the token hash, which is the entropy that's being held on the Ethereum blockchain. And it's being, and what's created on a server is the template. It's a standard HTML template that has a head. And then inside the body, it has, you know, the script for the library, if necessary. If it's a pure JavaScript thing, there's no need for a script. And then it has the algorithm itself. So in the browser, you're concatenating all of the components that are necessary to be able to run that script. And now, since there's some beautiful people in this ecosystem that have uploaded, for example, P5JS is now entirely on chain. 3JS is now entirely on chain. And the vast majority, I'd say like, gosh, maybe 98%, 99% of things on ArtBlocks and other platforms use P5JS and 3JS. And so now it's really a matter of, you know, if ArtBlocks disappears, what you need to be able to reproduce that in your browser is the ability to form a basic HTML template, which has a head, a body, that pulls in all these pieces. There's a future where, you know, it could be distant future because I just don't see the server world collapsing in the next 5 years, but there's a future where there's beautiful implementations. There's a scripty library, there's a couple different things that have been happening on the ArtBlock side in terms of dependencies, where one day the smart contract won't just feed you the algorithm and the token hash, but one day the smart contract will feed you the entire HTML file. So just in case in 20 years when maybe like all million copies of P5JS are destroyed from people's servers. I mean, again, these are like really weird black swan type events. The entire thing from the HTML template to the algorithm to the token hash to the script itself are all fed from the smart contract directly. And that is like the pinnacle of being purely on-chain and decentralized. And that's something that we can achieve absolutely with the smart contract technology that exists today, plus with the scripts that have now been put on the blockchain. And but it's not a trivial thing to do. And we have to gauge like how important that is today versus other things that would make things more exciting. For example, the first thing that you mentioned, which is like minting mechanics and minting experience. So one of the things that I'm really excited about is, and this keeps getting delayed because gosh, like ArtBlock grows in so many different directions sometimes, but like things like the noun style minter, but for generative art, where every 15 minutes or every hour, an auction generates a new output, like a new ArtBlock style artwork, and then people can bid on it individually. And the release of a generative artwork drags on instead of being like this 10-minute thing with a Dutch auction. It actually might last like a year with like one piece being generated every day. There's some other fun stuff like a chaos minter that we have in mind. There's a few different really fun ideas. And so to me, what's really important, which is not a deal breaker in terms of what ArtBlock builds, but something that I find core as an important feature of ArtBlock, is that ArtBlock is air-gapped. What that means is that humans have no ability to intervene into what is algorithmically created. And so that means that the hash is generated from on-chain data, pseudo-random data that's generated on-chain. The moment that you start air-gapping, the moment that you have the opportunity, for example, that an artwork would have multiples of the exact same output. Maybe it's just something as simple as the artist made a mistake and injects the hash, what you're describing, the idea of pre-curating the work. If an artist makes a mistake in an immutable way where they mint zero by injecting the hash, and some reason they copy-pasted the wrong hash into mint one, that mint one is now immutably identical to mint zero. And so it's no longer a one of X. It's a one of two of X or something. I don't know. So the surface area for mistakes, for attacks, start to increase when you stop air gapping the technology. And this goes all the way up to like the idea of having an operator filter, where like the operator filter might help you preserve royalties, but in exchange is allowing the human to interact with the smart contract and be able to make some decisions as to how that artwork is displayed in the future, in a way kind of like eroding a little bit of the value proposition of a self-sovereign asset and something that cannot be altered by humans. So technology continues to advance, and we continue to have really fun ideas of like minting mechanics. I have seen just over the course of the last year a lot of platforms that have come up where people have pre-curated work, and I think the work is just so stunning. And there's like this missed opportunity where like the pre-curated work is generative. It's created by an algorithm that could be on chain, but the pre-curated work is living on IPFS because it's just like a pre-generated image. And I love that work, and I've collected a lot of that work. But like, what does it look like to allow pre-curation and what you're describing and still allow the value proposition of on-chain generative art? And I guess I'll close that off by saying that I recently discovered an artist through Patrick Avedon's 404 gallery, kind of emerging artist submissions, that I collected one of his works, I want to say on OpenSea or maybe Manifold, and he shared a second one. It's made entirely by P5JS. And I was like, hey, man, like that's a beautiful output. What do you think about taking that and putting it on chain? And so what he did was take it to Prohibition, uploaded the entire algorithm with a preset deterministic output as a one of one, and something that I've been actually like dreaming of collecting for the last 2.5 years is a one of one fully on-chain generative artwork. And I was able to collect that this morning. And so we're making these progresses into like exploring what the artist feels comfortable with in terms of outside inputs from the blockchain, and what happened on that algorithm while it sacrificed the kind of on-demand generative moment of minting, that moment where you get to like be surprised and delighted by something new. It also made it to where that artist was comfortable releasing that work and kept it fully on chain. And when all those things kind of come together, I think something really powerful happens. So don't have a straight answer for that other than, you know, we want to be open, not just to like being so crazy strict about everything, but hosting some of the best art in the world. And I do think that the on-chain generative art experience where you don't know what you're going to get compels the artist to go back and tweak their algorithm and be tighter about what they're doing so that they are pre-approving anything that could come out of the minter. I think it elevates the quality of the work by forcing the artist to do that. But at the same time, it's like, does that mean that we're missing out on other brilliant examples of on-chain generative art? Probably. And so, you know, being malleable to that. On Artblocks flagship, that's probably not something that would happen anytime soon. On Artblocks engine, where partners have the ability to bring in external assets and to do more experimental stuff, absolutely, we're already seeing examples of that. And time will tell what people put the most value in.
Wow, thank you. Thank you for this elaborate and technical answer. Thank you, Eric.
Thank you, Seven. Great question. Learned a whole lot. So I appreciate you coming up here. Eric, where can we see, like, what's your vision for Artblocks? What do we as people who participate in this space and love to see innovation and the growth of Artblocks? Take us on your vision of where you're headed with this.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of where I'm headed right now isn't specific to Artblocks because I feel this, and I've shared this with a lot of my friends and colleagues, that like I feel this kind of crazy weight on my shoulder, not just to support the Squiggle or Artblocks or artists on Artblocks or the Artblocks ecosystem, but the NFT ecosystem as a whole. I feel like there's a lot of friction, there's a lot of bad vibes, there's a lot of uncertainty. And to me, the value proposition of why we're here has not changed. And it is like more bullish than ever, in my opinion, especially in a bear market when we've seen that digital art and also generative art have thrived relatively, obviously, compared to some other stuff. I do think that like in order to sustain our current organization at Artblocks and like our ecosystem as a whole, we have to catalyze an increase in adoption for both digital objects and generative content in general. And I think that this is like the most critical and solvable problem that is facing our space. And so a lot of what I'm thinking about and like some of what I'm working with Jordan on for Prohibition and trying, when I speak to artists and they ask me, hey, what do you see as the future, is what does it look like to create something that is desirable to a broader consumer market? We have inherently in the NFT ecosystem created the most heavy barriers to entry to the crypto curious, the digital art curious, the generative curious people because of our minting mechanics, our Dutch auctions. Like for art, let me just take a step back. Perfect for art, things that are based on scarcity, things that are based on like price discovery, things that have to sell for like, you know, hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars. But other than like saying, hey, look, come into NFT space, you can make a lot of money. It's really hard to convince people to enter the NFT space. And so I think that there's a massive opportunity to start considering what lower cost, high value goods are within the NFT ecosystem. And to me, that means like digital objects that are optionally physical and physical objects that are optionally digital, things that are at a lower price point. This concept of an inclusive edition, which is something that, you know, I've been thinking about for a while that I got to work out with Jordan recently of like, you know, When a company makes a new product and they put it out on the market, they don't say, like if it's Lego and they have a new car, they don't say, hey, I'm only going to make 500,000 of these and you can only buy them for 3 months. They just like put something out there and the supply is based on the demand. And so Lego has to make decisions as to like when they have new products to bring to market, they're going to replace the products that aren't selling as well with the new products that they're bringing to market. They're not just like arbitrarily saying, I'm going to make this thing at this price under this price point. And so really trying to think about what a normal consumer process is for acquiring a good and applying that to digital goods, which is complicated because by nature we are talking about digital objects. And while digital culture is expanding at a very quick rate in society, it's still hard to give value to a digital object beyond scarcity. So really spending time on consumer habits and consumer behaviors and thinking, okay, as a non-crypto person, what is going to bring my curiosity to this thing? And I've really settled on the idea that like for the that anything that we do in that realm cannot ignore our crypto community. It's like Kickstarter, right? Like they have to have like first right. They have to have the first opportunities and the best opportunities because they've been here. They're the reason that we're here in the first place. But doing that in a way that prevents external people from buying a $20 thing feels wrong to me. So if I work on a project and it's priced at $20 and it's an addition of 1,000, there's no world where that thing is going to be able to be put into a box as a physical product and marketed to a retailer. So what does it mean to make products that don't have this addition, arbitrary addition size, that allow us to like explore packaging design and physical forms and what that means is, you know, very high additions, like not really setting an addition, setting low price points and making this accessible to both the digital and the physical consumer at the same time. And really trying to inspire other people to be thinking about those things, because the single biggest problem, and it's a solvable problem, but the single most critical problem facing our ecosystem is a lack of curiosity from people outside wanting to participate in this ecosystem. And again, in 2021, that curiosity was mostly based on financial incentives, but also because publications were talking about crypto left and right. Well, that's tied down a little bit. What is the trigger? What is the catalyst for people to come into our ecosystem today? And this to me feels like a solvable approach to at least trying it. I mean, you know, a lot of what our blocks was in the first place was creative content, like releasing stuff in this distribution mechanism. And I don't feel comfortable going to my grave without at least giving this a shot. And I think this is the single, for me, most likely way that we're going to increase curiosity and adoption in a broader consumer base into crypto. And those people that enter that way, are they going to be presented with Doodles and CryptoPunks and Squiggles and all the art block stuff and all the engine stuff and the Bright Moment stuff? And they'll be going into this in a much more open-minded, curious manner, which will allow them to discover like the beautiful things that you can do with generative art and content.
I want to tell you, Eric, that this has been incredible pinch me now moment to have you up here as our guest speaker for this week. I have infinite gratitude and feel infinitely just blessed and lucky, and I have no idea how the hell I ended up here to be able to speak so many epic people every single week, and you are far one of those people that I am just lucky and blessed to have up here. From the bottom of my heart, I wish you nothing but success. I think that it is a hard, you know, it is a hard responsibility, and it's a lot of responsibility. You do bear a lot of weight, I think, from a lot of people that see you as one of the backbones, as one of the pillars of the NFT space and as one of the digital art space. With that comes a lot of responsibility, but it also comes with a lot of gratitude from a lot of artists and people in the space that have learned from you or been able to lift themselves up on your shoulder. So I'm pretty sure that everybody would agree with me. Let's see some hearts out there, that everybody would agree with me that we are behind you and we are supporting you. And with that comes my question, what else can we do to support you?
Oh man, that's a good question. I don't get that one very often. Well, I mean, I honestly, again, this wouldn't be here. We wouldn't be here today without the people that we work with and supporting, not just me, but my team and you know, our artists and our collectors and being gentle. I think the biggest thing, the easiest thing that I can think of is that people need to just kind of take the edge off a little bit of their communications and be a little bit more gentle and put themselves into other people's shoes. And not necessarily think that the things that they think are right are what's actually right. And even if it is what's actually right, that might not be what the person that you're talking to thinks is right. And we really are all doing our best. I think that just giving people the opportunity to like just do their best and not have to fight so much with like, you know, the dogma of like what is right and what is wrong, I think is the most important thing that we can do for each other. And I think that, you know, getting good constructive criticism is really positive. I have a lot of people that think I'm delusional with these ideas of digital optional, physical optional, and like the physical object ownership thing. And that's good. It's great criticism. A lot of it has guided my approach to like, it's been filtered down from what the original delusion was to this new delusion that's a lot more succinct. So, and then just like, you know, paying gratitude for the people, a lot of the people that are on this call that are supporting you know, this ecosystem, the beautiful artists on this call. I mean, you have Bob Lucas in this call. He's doing some really wonderful things for artists in support of generative art and like with an incubator. You've got like multiple team members that are on this call that literally are like working hard, not just to understand what you guys want, but also to understand what I want, which I just have so much gratitude for, because they could also just be like, yeah, this, you know, I'm super grateful for that glitch. I'm just kind of scrolling through a few of these people, artists here. I mean, it's just like a really wonderful place to be right now. I feel infinitely supported. I do feel a lot of weight on my shoulders. I feel like I have a lot of people to please and a lot of people to make happy. But just know that like that sentiment is felt within the entire Artblocks team. We are trying to do our best to figure this out, navigate this space, and create the best tools, the best stuff, the best value for participating in this ecosystem. And the fact that the positive impact that Artblocks has had in general in the NFT space is felt outside of generative art is powerful. And we have an opportunity to do more. And so just support each other. I think you guys supporting each other is probably the single best thing that you guys can do for me, so I don't get derailed thinking about bickering and trying to think about how to get more people to care about your bags, for lack of a better word. So yeah, that's really kind of what it boils down to.
I think we got that down pat. We do us. No problem. I want to remind everybody, don't forget to register for your Po app. Go up there. It is a pinned tweet. Remember, this is the launch that we did for Space Caps Po app with Tao. It means world to me, this partnership, because it's everything that I've been. So today you would be collecting the special snow frozen on there. By the way, I forgot to ask you this on here, and I forgot to ask you, Snowfro, tell us what name Snowfro.
I started a snow cone stand in college. Wait, when the name came from? Yeah, I started a snow cone stand in college called Snowfro Refreshments. This was in 2000. Maybe 2001. And it just kind of became a bit of my nickname. And I had the website snowfro.com. And when I started when I started jumping into NFTs, everybody was like pseudonymous. And so that was the first thing that came to mind. I do think it represents a bit of my journey. That was my first big endeavor. I got a loan, bought a big snow cone machine, a truck, a stand, and hired people. It is reminiscent of kind of like my journey here. And snow cones are very colorful. And, you know, there's a little bit of like a connected dialogue here from that to the things that I do today. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that's an awesome story. It also was at UT, which I'm super familiar with. So I think that it's an awesome story. Yeah. Super awesome story. And a full circle moment, you know, of this is now, I mean, this is now the way that we recognize you in a very entrepreneurial, but also super duper creative way. So I think that it fits you perfectly. And so it would be remiss of me if I didn't ask you about a little bit about that. So Eric, thank you so much for joining us today. Is there anything else that I didn't ask you about that you want to talk about right now?
No. Just want to say thank you, and thank you everybody here. Thank you for being excited about on-chain generative art and just NFTs in general, digital art in general. And yeah, thanks for having me. Very honored to be here.
All right, let's go. That's it for today's show, everyone. Don't forget about that Space Caps Po app. Thank you so much for joining us today. You could have been absolutely everywhere, anywhere else, and you were with us. If you haven't already, make sure that you are following me, that you're following Eric. I'm pretty sure that we all are. We do this show every single Wednesday at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time. And if you didn't know, now you know. I'll see you next week, everybody. Have a good one.
Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Thanks, Eric.
Si te olvidaste de mí, yo sé que fue una noche nada más, que no se vuelve a repetir. Tal vez en ti quise encontrar lo que en otra perdí. Tu orgullo no me quiere hablar, entonces vamos a competir. A ver, ey, no me gusta perder. dime qué vamos a hacer. Me paso mirando el cel, wow, no puede ser. Aunque me tarde un poco, juro que voy a responder. Quisiera volverte a ver. Quisiera volverte a ver encima de brincando. Lo rico que te ve chingando. No sé qué estamos esperando. El orgullo no está ganando. Ay, baby, dime la verdad. Si te olvidaste de mí, yo sé que fue una noche nada más. Que no se vuelve a repetir. Tal vez en ti quise encontrar. Ay, lo que en otra perdí. Tu orgullo no me quiere hablar. Entonces vamos a competir. A ver. Ey, desde que nos vimos en cómo nos comimos. Ey, después dividimos cada cual por su camino. En la alfombra aún están las manchas de vino. ¿Dónde es ese totito que lleva tiempo perdido? Si te digo que me gusta, que estás buena, no lo tomes por cumplir. Es que yo soy un bellaco, es que yo soy un atrevido. Ey. Y hace tiempo que quiero chingar contigo. Mami, te voy a dar hasta que te dé la popola como a Glow. Me gusta el Glow. Tranquilita, tú siempre estás el show. Una perversa del dembow. Si se ponen algo o el chingo. Que no se vuelva a repetir. Tal vez en ti quise encontrar lo que en otra perdí. Tu orgullo no quiere hablar. Entonces vamos a competir. Ey.